This is the story.
Tonight, the World Security Workshop presents a report by one of America's elder statesmen, Henry L. Stimson, former Secretary of State and twice Secretary of War, serving four presidents, William Howard Taft and Herbert Hoover, Republicans, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Harry S. Truman, Democrats. He has served his country without regard to party affiliation. His report, appearing in the February issue of Harper's Magazine, is of the gravest importance to every American, detailing for the first time the thinking and the policies behind the atomic bomb. Here in a special radio adaptation is The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb by Henry L. Stimson.
This is Joseph DeSantis. Mr. Stimson begins his report as follows. In recent months, there has been much comment about the decision to use atomic bombs in attacks on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This decision was one of the gravest made by our government in recent years, and it is entirely proper that it should be widely discussed. I have therefore decided to record, for all who may be interested, my understanding of the events which led up to the attack on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, on Nagasaki on August 9th, and the Japanese decision to surrender on August 10th. It was in the fall of 1941 that the question of atomic energy was first brought directly to my attention. At that time, President Roosevelt appointed a committee consisting of Vice President Wallace, General Marshall, Dr. Vannevar Bush, Dr. James B. Conant, and myself. The function of this committee was to advise the President on questions of policy relating to the study of nuclear fission, which was then proceeding both in this country and in Great Britain.
The fall of 1941. The fall of 1941 turned to winter as the bombs brought World War II to American soil. And the numberless duties of wartime Secretary of War descended on Henry Stimson. Of the major problem before him then, he writes,
"For nearly 4 years thereafter, I was directly connected with all major decisions of policy on the development and use of atomic energy. And from May 1st, 1943, until my resignation as Secretary of War on September 21st, 1945, I was directly responsible to the President for the administration of the entire undertaking. At the same time, I was the President's senior advisor on the military employment of atomic energy. The policy adopted and steadily pursued by President Roosevelt and his advisors was a simple one. It was to spare no effort in securing the earliest possible successful development of an atomic weapon. The reasons for this policy were equally simple. The original experimental achievement of atomic fission had occurred in Germany in 1938, and it was known that the Germans had continued their experiments. In 1941 and 1942, they were believed to be ahead of us, and it was vital that they should not be the first to bring atomic weapons into the field of battle."
In the security of our bomb-free American homes, the war news seemed scattered, dull, unexciting.
Why'd they get going with this war? Nothing happened, except maybe these commando raids the British have been pulling in Norway. And what do they say about them? Nothing. Just mission accomplished.
No, they didn't say in 1942. Much, much later, we found out.
The famous commando raid on Norway, which made headlines in 1942... wrecked a heavy water plant which the Nazis were using to develop atomic weapons. That raid set them back many years.
Yes. And Mr. Stimson continues?
"Furthermore, if we should be the first to develop the weapon, we should have a great new instrument for shortening the war and minimizing destruction. At no time from 1941 to 1945 that I ever hear it suggested by the president or by any other responsible member of the government that atomic energy should not be used in the war. President Roosevelt particularly spoke to me many times of his own awareness of the catastrophic potentialities of our work. But we were at war, and the work must be done. I therefore emphasized that it was our common objective throughout the war to be the first to produce an atomic weapon and use it. The extraordinary story of the successful development of the atomic bomb has been well told elsewhere.
Hahn and Strassmann proved in 1939 that an isotope of barium was produced by neutron bombardment of uranium.
Two refugees from Germany, O.R. Frisch and Lisa Meitner, applied Albert Einstein's 1905 formula to a process called fission.
Niels Bohr and Enrico Fermi discussed the subject in Washington in 1939.
December 2nd, 1942. The first self-sustaining atomic pile was originated at Stagg Field, Chicago.
As time went on, it became clear that the weapon would not be available in time for use in the European theater, and the war against Germany was successfully ended by the use of what are now called conventional means. But in the spring of 1945, it became evident that the climax of our prolonged atomic effort was at hand. On March 15, 1945, I had my last talk with President Roosevelt. My diary record of this conversation gives a fairly clear picture of the state of our thinking at that time. I have removed the name of the distinguished public servant who was fearful lest the Manhattan atomic project be a lemon. It was an opinion common among those not fully informed.
The president had suggested that I come over to lunch today. First, I took up with him a memorandum which he sent to me from, and here I delete the name, who had been alarmed at the rumors of extravagance in the Manhattan project. This person suggested that it might become disastrous, and he suggested that we get a body of outside scientists to pass upon the project because rumors are going around that Vannevar Bush and Jim Conant have sold the president a lemon on the subject and ought to be checked up on. It was rather a jittery and nervous memorandum and rather silly. And I was prepared for it, and I gave the president a list of the scientists who are actually engaged on it to show the very high standing of them. And it comprised four Nobel Prize men, and also how practically every physicist of standing was engaged with us in the project. Then I outlined to him the future of it, and when it was likely to come off, and told him how important it was to get ready. I went over with him the two schools of thought that exist in respect to the future control after the war of this project, in case it is successful. One of them being the secret, close-in attempted control of the project by those who control it now, and the other being the international control based upon freedom both of science and of access. I told him that those things must be settled before the first projectile is used, and that he must be ready with a statement to come out to the people on it just as soon as that is done. He agreed to that.
Thus, Henry Stimson in his diary, March 15, 1945, 1 year, 10 months, 22 days ago. Where were our eyes on March 15, 1945?
On Iwo Jima, where the United States Marines were clearing out the last remnants of Japanese resistance.
On Tokyo, where 300 B-29s had blanketed 15 square miles of the city with fire.
On Germany, where American troops were mounting an offensive against Koblenz.
And on March 15, 1945, with the president's report on the Yalta Agreement ringing in our ears, we, with all the rest of the world, were unaware that less than 1 month later, as Henry Stimson has written,
I did not see Franklin Roosevelt again. The next time I went to the White House to discuss atomic energy was April 25, 1945. And I went to explain the nature of the problem to a man whose only previous knowledge of our activities was that of a senator who had loyally accepted our assurance that the matter must be kept a secret from him. Now he was president and commander-in-chief, and the final responsibility in this, as in so many other matters, must be his. President Truman accepted this responsibility with the same fine spirit that Senator Truman had shown before in accepting our refusal to inform him. I discussed with him the whole history of the project. We had with us General Groves, who explained in detail the progress which had been made and the probable future course of the work. I also discussed with President Truman the broader aspects of the subject, and the memorandum which I used in this discussion is again a fair sample of the state of our thinking at the time.
Memorandum discussed with President Truman, April 25th, 1945.
Within 4 months, we shall in all probability have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city.
Although we have shared its development with the United Kingdom,
Physically, the United States is at present in the position of controlling the resources with which to construct and use it, and no other nation could reach this position for some years.
Nevertheless, it is practically certain that we could not remain in this position indefinitely. A, various segments of its discovery and production are widely known among many scientists in many countries, although few scientists are now acquainted with the whole process which we have developed. B, although its construction under present methods requires great scientific and industrial effort and raw materials, it is extremely probable that much easier and cheaper methods of production will be discovered by scientists in the future, together with the use of materials of much wider distribution.
As a result, it is indicated that the future may see a time when such a weapon may be constructed in secret and used suddenly and effectively with devastating power by a willful nation or group against an unsuspecting nation or group of much greater size and material power. With its aid, even a very powerful, unsuspecting nation might be conquered within a very few days by a very much smaller one.
The world, in its present state of moral advancement, compared with its technical development, would be eventually at the mercy of such a weapon. In other words, modern civilization might be completely destroyed.
To approach any world peace organization of any pattern now likely to be considered, without an appreciation by the leaders of our country of the power of this new weapon, would seem to be unrealistic. No system of control heretofore considered would be adequate to control this menace, both inside any particular country and between the nations of the world. The control of this weapon will undoubtedly be a matter of the greatest difficulty and would involve such thoroughgoing rites of inspection and internal controls as we have never heretofore contemplated.
Furthermore, in the light of our present position with reference to this weapon, the question of sharing it with other nations and, if so shared, upon what terms, becomes a primary question of our foreign relations. Also, our leadership in the war and in the development of this weapon has placed a certain moral responsibility upon us, which we cannot shirk without very serious responsibility for any disaster to civilization which it would further.
On the other hand, if the problem of the proper use of this weapon can be solved, we would have the opportunity to bring the world into a pattern in which the peace of the world and our civilization can be saved.
It's strange about days and dates sometimes, isn't it? On the 25th of April, 1945, Henry Stimson, Secretary of War, discussed that memorandum with the President of the United States. Yes, and on April 25th, 1945...
San Francisco. The representatives of 51 United Nations gathered here today in their first plenary session to draw a document to be known as the United Nations Charter. As President Harry Truman was held in Washington by the pressing business of war, Secretary of State...
Well, all I say is, April 25th, 1945, better mark the beginning of a real world organization. It's just no use fooling ourselves. A weak United Nations without real power will mean that eventually there'll be another war. And who knows what horrible kinds of destruction will be invented 20 years from now.
20 years from April 25th, 1945? That very day, the work was going forward at Oak Ridge, at Hanford, Washington, at Los Alamos, New Mexico, and in Washington, D.C.
As Henry Stimson tells about it,
the next step in our preparations was the appointment of the interim committee, charged with the function of advising the president on the various questions raised by our apparently imminent success in developing an atomic weapon. I was its chairman, but the principal labor of guiding its extended deliberations fell to George L. Harrison, who acted as chairman in my absence. It will be useful to consider the work of the committee in some detail. Its members were the following, in addition to Mr. Harrison and myself.
James F. Burns, then a private citizen, as personal representative of the president.
Ralph A. Bard, Undersecretary of the Navy.
William L. Clayton, Assistant Secretary of State.
Dr. Vannevar Bush, Director, Office of Scientific Research and Development, and President of the Carnegie Institution of Washington.
Dr. Carl T. Compton, Chief of the Office of Field Service in the Office of Scientific Research and Development, and President of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Dr. James B. Conant, Chairman of the National Defense Research Committee and President of Harvard University.
The discussions of the committee ranged over the whole field of atomic energy and its political, military, and scientific aspects. That part of its work which particularly concerns us here relates to its recommendations for the use of atomic energy against Japan. But it should be borne in mind that these recommendations were not made in a vacuum. The interim committee was assisted in its work by a scientific panel whose members were the following: Dr. A. H. Compton, Dr. Enrico Fermi, Dr. E. O. Lawrence, and Dr. J. R. Oppenheimer. All four were nuclear physicists of the first rank. All four had held positions of great importance in the atomic project from its inception. At a meeting with the interim committee in the scientific panel on May 31st, 1945, I urged all those present to feel free to express themselves on any phase of the subject, scientific or political. Both General Marshall and I at this meeting expressed the view that atomic energy could not be considered simply in terms of military weapons, but must also be considered in terms of a new relationship of man to the universe.
And men in Washington, one of them in a commanding position at this moment, were contemplating the beginning of a new world, a new life, a new horizon. And on the 1st of June, 1945, President Truman, speaking for the nation, warned the Japanese,
"The United States will more than double its fighting force in the Pacific within 1 year. What has happened to Tokyo by air bombing will happen to every city that feeds the Japanese war machine."
That same day, according to Mr. Stimson?
On June 1st, after its discussions with the scientific panel, the interim committee unanimously adopted the following recommendations. 1. The bomb should be used against Japan as soon as possible. 2. It should be used on a dual target, that is, a military installation or war plant surrounded by or adjacent to houses and other buildings most susceptible to damage. And 3. It should be used without prior warning of the nature of the weapon. One member of the committee, Mr. Bard, later changed his view and dissented from Recommendation 3. In reaching these conclusions, the interim committee carefully considered such alternatives as a detailed advance warning or a demonstration in some uninhabited area. Both of these suggestions were discarded as impractical. They were not regarded as likely to be effective in compelling a surrender of Japan, and both of them involved serious risks. Nothing would have been more damaging to our effort to obtain surrender than a warning or a demonstration followed by a dud. And this was a real possibility. Furthermore, we had no bombs to waste. It was vital that a sufficient effect be quickly obtained with the few we had.
June 1945, and the climax was approaching. What it was to be or when, we could not tell. But great events were casting shadows. The maps in our newspapers told their story.
The Philippines, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, secured.
B-29s operating from Guam, Saipan, and Tinian, with fighter plane support from Iwo, intensified the fire raids on Japanese home islands.
The net was closing. In the midst of it was the Mikado. And far away in Washington, decisions were taking form and shape. The door to a new kind of world was about to be unlocked. In the words of Henry Stimson,
the interim committee and the scientific panel also served as a channel through which suggestions from other scientists working on the atomic project were forwarded to me and to the president. Among the suggestions thus forwarded was one memorandum which questioned using the bomb at all against the enemy. On June 16, 1945, after consideration of that memorandum, the scientific panel made a report from which I quote the following.
The opinions of our scientific colleagues on the initial use of these weapons are not unanimous. They range from the proposal of a purely technical demonstration to that of the military application best designed to induce surrender. We find ourselves closer to these latter views. We can propose no technical demonstration likely to bring an end to the war. We see no acceptable alternative to direct military use.
The foregoing discussion presents the reasoning of the interim committee and its advisors. The committee's function was, of course, entirely advisory. The ultimate responsibility for the recommendation to the president rested upon me, and I have no desire to veil it. The conclusions of the committee were similar to my own, although I reached mine independently. I felt that to extract a genuine surrender from the emperor and his military advisors, they must be administered a tremendous shock, which would carry convincing proof of our power to destroy the empire. Such an effective shock would save many times the number of lives, both American and Japanese, that it would cost. With these considerations in mind, I wrote a memorandum for the president on July 2nd, which, I believe, fairly represents the thinking of the American government as it finally took shape in action. When I discussed it with the president, he expressed his general approval.
July 2nd, 1945, memorandum for the president. Proposed program for Japan.
The plans of operation up to and including the first landing have been authorized, and the preparations for the operation are now actually going on.
If we once land on one of the main islands and begin a forceful occupation of Japan, we shall probably have cast the die of last-ditch resistance.
A question then comes. Is there any alternative to such a forceful occupation of Japan which will secure for us the equivalent of an unconditional surrender of her forces and the permanent destruction of her power again to strike an aggressive blow at the peace of the Pacific?
I believe Japan is susceptible to reason in such a crisis to a much greater extent than is indicated by our current press and other current comments.
On the other hand, I think that the attempt to exterminate her armies and her populations by gunfire or other means will tend to produce a fusion of race solidity and antipathy.
Success, of course, will depend on the potency of the warning which we give her.
It is, therefore, my conclusion that a carefully timed warning be given to Japan by the chief representatives of the United States, Great Britain, China, and, if then a belligerent, Russia, by calling upon Japan to surrender and permit the occupation of her country in order to ensure its complete demilitarization for the sake of the future peace.
It is important to emphasize the double character of the suggested warning. It was designed to promise destruction if Japan resisted and hope if she surrendered. The Potsdam Ultimatum of July 26th very closely followed the above memorandum of July 2nd, when it stated that if the Japanese continue the war, quote, the full application of our military power, backed by our resolve, will mean the inevitable and complete destruction of the Japanese armed forces and just as inevitably the utter devastation of the Japanese homeland. For such a purpose, the atomic bomb was an eminently suitable weapon. The New Mexico test occurred while we were at Potsdam on July 16th. It was immediately clear that the power of the bomb measured up to our highest estimates. We had developed a weapon of such a revolutionary character that its use against the enemy might well be expected to produce exactly the kind of shock on the Japanese ruling oligarchy which we desired, strengthening the position of those who wished peace and weakening that of the military party. Because of the importance of the atomic mission against Japan, the detailed plans were brought to me by the military staff for approval. I approved four targets, including the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
August 6, 1945. Hiroshima. Dead and missing, 70,000.
August 9th, 1945. Nagasaki. Dead and missing, 35,000.
Russia enters the war against Japan.
September 2nd, 1945. Japan signs the surrender terms in Tokyo Bay.
Our great objective was thus achieved, and all the evidence I have seen indicates that the controlling factor in the final Japanese decision to accept our terms of surrender was the atomic bomb. The two atomic bombs which we had dropped were the only ones we had ready, and our rate of production at the time was very small. But the atomic bomb was more than a weapon of terrible destruction. It was a psychological weapon. As Dr. Carl Compton has said,
it was not one atomic bomb or two which brought surrender. It was the experience of what an atomic bomb will actually do to a community, plus the dread of many more that was effective.
The bomb thus served exactly the purpose we intended. In the foregoing, I have tried to give an accurate account of my own personal observations of the circumstances which led up to the use of the atomic bomb and the reasons which underlay our use of it. To me, they have always seemed compelling and clear, and I cannot see how any person vested with such responsibilities as mine could have taken any other course or given any other advice to his chief. Two great nations were approaching contact in a fight to a finish, which would begin with our projected invasion on November 1st, 1945. As long as the Japanese government refused to surrender, we should be forced to take and hold the ground and smash the Japanese ground armies by close-in fighting of the same desperate and costly kind that we had faced in the Pacific Islands for nearly 4 years. My chief purpose was to end the war in victory with the least possible cost in the lives of the men and the armies which I had helped to raise. The face of war is the face of death. Death is an inevitable part of every order that a wartime leader gives. The decision to use the atomic bomb was a decision that brought death to over 100,000 Japanese. No explanation can change that fact. and I do not wish to gloss it over. But this deliberate, premeditated destruction was our least abhorrent choice. The destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki put an end to the Japanese war. It stopped the fire raid and the strangling blockade. It ended the ghastly specter of a clash of great land armies. In this last great action of the Second World War, we were given final proof that war is death. War in the 20th century has grown steadily more barbarous, more destructive, more debased in all its aspects. Now, with the release of atomic energy, man's ability to destroy himself is very nearly complete. The bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended a war. They also made it wholly clear that we must never have another war. This is the lesson men and leaders everywhere must learn. And I believe that when they learn it, they will find a way to lasting peace. There is no other choice.
You have heard the decision to use the atomic bomb, the report written by former Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson. It was directed by Clark Andrews and adapted for radio by Ira Marion from Mr. Stimson's article in a recent issue of Harper's Magazine. We invite you to be with us again next week for This is the Story. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.